Okay, welcome everybody. My name is Amelia Ascari, and I teach at the University of Michigan. Worked for a long time at the Detroit Free Press, and very happy today to be here as your moderator for this session on reporting about lead and next steps in this really very important and very complicated story that seems to have been around for a very long time. So we have a really distinguished panel of people who have different perspectives and experiences to share related to this topic. I'm not going to give you long introductions because we have very detailed bios up on the conference website. And so invite you to take a look there and refer to it later if you have interest in following up on some of the clicks to some of their pieces that have been written related to this topic. We are going to record this session, so it's all on the record. We are going to leave plenty of time for interaction with you hear your questions and answer them and have conversation and dialogue on this topic. That's going to be our main focus. As moderator, I've asked that all of our panelists not present any PowerPoints or a kind of opening remarks. We're going to go pretty much straight to moderator-led questions for a few minutes, and then we'll open that up to Q&A. So on my right here is Michael Pell from Reuters, I want to give a shout-out to the Oaks Awards in Environmental Journalism, which paid for Michael's trip here. Michael is, and his reporting partner, Joshua Scher, won the Oaks Award this year for their very in-depth, data-driven series of stories related to lead poisoning. I thought that sort of as a sort of state of the story right now, it would be interesting to start first with the video because I'm not sure about everybody's background on this issue. So this will be kind of a recap of sort of the state of the lead story at the moment. And 143. The in-queue was bubbly and energetic.
Bubbly and energetic. And she was. She was a little girl who lives in the Bronx. She got lead poisoning. But 142, does that work?
Yes, it's good.
Good.
And then we're going to go out on, in the worst case, coma and death. Wait, we're not plugged into the sound.
Whoops.
We don't have a sound cape. Okay, we're going to just put the mic next to it. Let's try that.
I'll jack up the volume here. That's a good problem.
So who's the youngest person in the room?
My mother says she's had hyperactivity and a speech impediment, but she's in a better situation than
now.
She's undergone speech therapy, and once inspectors found lead paint in her home, her family was able to relocate.
Not even scissors.
You got it right here.
You try to put this mic on it too.
Cases of coma or death. Jada's grandmother says she's had hyperactivity and a speech impediment, but she's in a better situation than many. She's undergone speech therapy, and once inspectors found lead paint in her home, her family was able to relocate to temporary housing, operated by Montefiore Hospital, and used to keep poisoned children away from the homes where they were exposed to lead.
We didn't want to discharge a kid back home after spending 5-6 days in the hospital, to the place they got lead poisoned, if nothing had been done to fix it, because they were going to come right back and potentially much worse, end up in the intensive care unit, encephalopathic, or dying from it. So we started having a temporary apartment that the hospital had as guest housing, and we filled that, and we filled two. And then They got us a building.
But many families have no way of knowing if their children have been exposed to lead. Reuters found, for example, that despite a New York state law requiring universal testing, in some counties, fewer than 10% of children have been screened as the state rules require.
Good enough. That's exactly what we meant to do.
So Derek's very powerful. I mean, Mike's very powerful stories. Do you want to recap the findings very briefly and talk about the impact that you've had with the other
Sure.
people, especially the scientists reaching out to you to take a look at your data?
Sure. So, following the crisis in Flint, Josh and I both wanted to look at other communities that were also suffering from lead exposure, because we looked at Flint and thought that surely this can't be the only city in the country that has this problem. And over the course of the year, we had a very kind of organic approach. We found a couple of things. First of all, as we just said right there, kids weren't being tested. And this kind of stems from a complacency among public health officials and providers as well. We talked to a lot of pediatricians that said, lead is not a problem. And if lead is a problem, don't you worry. We can identify those kids. We talked to a lot of state officials, too, that said, yeah, don't worry. We can identify the kids that are going to be lead poison, and then we'll make sure those kids get tested. It turns out that's not the case. They're not real good at doing that. In fact, they're really bad at doing that. And even among Medicaid children who are required by federal law to be tested at ages 1 and 2 because they're at a higher risk of lead poisoning, we found out that South Carolina tests 5% of kids. California tests 40% of kids in their Medicaid program. So even when they know where a high-risk kid is, they're not doing it. And as a result, senators and members of Congress got together and said, no, we need to do better than this. And they went to CMS and said, you need to make sure these states are doing this. Because a couple states even told us, we're not required to do that. Congress doesn't pay us to do that. Buzz off. And CMS and a couple members of Congress went to them and said, look, you're getting Medicaid funding. You are required to do this. Get on top of it. And at that point, they said, oh, we didn't really mean buzz off. We just meant, and from that story, we went to East Chicago. And I don't know if you folks remember last year, East Chicago was being evacuated because there was not the whole city, I'm sorry, a housing complex in East Chicago was being evacuated because there was it was built on a former lead smelter site. And it was a Superfund site. I mean, this was a place that they knew was one of the most toxic sites in America. And a couple of years before, about 4 years before the evacuation, ATSDR, a wing of CMS, came in and had done an assessment of the potential health impacts from lead to children in that housing complex. And they had said, no problems here. Kids are not going to get exposed. That's not happening. It's not going to happen. And so Josh and I obtained some data from the State Department of Health in Indiana and found out that each one of the ATSDR's claims about safety were completely wrong. ATSDR had said, in East Chicago, the rate of lead poisoning is similar to that of the rest of the country, plus 100% of kids are being tested, therefore we know what's going on. Well, it turns out more like 15 to 20% of kids were being tested. And even worse, that while East Chicago's rate of kids with elevated lead levels was similar to the rest of the country, according to the state data, the census tract where that Superfund site was located and where that housing complex was located, the rate of tested kids was actually much higher. In fact, it was more like 10 times the rate of the rest of the country. And that really showed to us the danger of looking at data in a broad, homogenized fashion. We wanted to look at granular data so that way we could see specific neighborhoods that were still having a problem. You might have a wealthy county with pockets of poverty or
a Superfund site or another high risk factor, and it turns out that those are the neighborhoods that are still suffering. And that's what we went to next, is what we went to each of the states and the CDC to obtain blood lead level testing data broken down by the census tract. And what we found were more than 3,000 census tracts and zip codes across the country where kids had elevated lead level, or tested kids were turning up with elevated lead levels at twice the rate of Flint during the peak of that city's crisis over the period that we had the data.
Thanks, Mike. I think I just want to hammer home this point that what really made this piece so powerful is the data that they were able to collect with lots of persistence with a Freedom of Information Act request to 50 different states. And it took a long time to get that data. And it produced this interactive map that is kind of the first compilation of a nationwide look at lead poisoning. I think there's several interesting points to make here. Is that they started looking at the Flint water crisis, and at some point they pivoted to look at lead blood levels. So, Michael, can you tell us briefly what compelled you to make that pivot?
Well, we felt like Flint was getting a lot of a well-deserved attention, and there was a lot of there was good reasons to pay attention to Flint. But we also felt that if people were outraged about what was going on in Flint, that they should look at what was going on in their own communities and across the country and see that there is plenty to be outraged about in other communities. You look what's going on in Baltimore, Buffalo. We did analysis in Buffalo. I mean, there are just – that is a community that has a lot of problems. They're working on the issue, but they still need they need help. Other cities like Cleveland and also rural communities as well across Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, it looks – if you look at it on the map, it looks like ground zero for lead poisoning. And that has to do a lot with the age of the housing and also its industrial past. And what we were able to do is kind of make this clear. We got a lot of data that when we published it, people from – researchers from across the country came to us and asked us to share this data with them. We're working on that right now. And even when we told them, well, you could go out and get this yourself. All you have to do is issue the exact same open records request that we did. They just kind of – we're not going to do that. I mean, and I think that shows the distance we still have to go as far as the barriers of access and public information laws are concerned. It's still difficult to do that. But that's also something that journalists can bring to public discourse and something that we specialize in. I hope that we all think about that.
No, we're going to have Q&A in a little while. I want to get each one of the panelists a chance to talk first. So hold on to that question. That's a good one. I want to emphasize as well that this was a story that was hiding in plain sight, that the government had collected some of this data. Well, it collected all this data. There were gaps in its collection, as Mike pointed out, that they were required to collect more than they did. But in fact, so often, as we know as journalists, sometimes like there are these requirements, reporting requirements, collection requirements, and then there's no analysis requirement, and people had not looked at the data, especially on a meta-national level. I just want to spend a quick moment looking at the interactive map that they produced. Does anybody in the audience want to shout out a zip code or a town that has some older housing, perhaps? We could show you the kind of information that's available publicly on the Reuters map. Database. Go ahead.
62901.
62901. Where is that?
Southern Illinois.
Rural Southern Illinois. Okay, let's have a look.
Do you have an address, maybe? Sorry.
You mean like a town?
No. Just like an
address in the 62901 area code.
Let's try 200 North Illinois Avenue.
Is this a place where you used to live? Okay.
Great. So
there should be any kids there.
That's funny.
In
is one of our more
well
it's an other small town.
Okay, let's take a look at it.
So I mean you got 429 kids tested. And this is just in 1 year, and 20% of those kids nearly had elevated lead levels. So, I mean, that's more than 80 kids in 1 year. If you think about all those kids going to school, I mean, each one of those kids is going to school with a background in elevated lead levels. That's not helpful.
Okay, hold on to that audience question. We want to give everybody on the panel a chance to talk first. And I just have one more question for Mike. And as you mentioned that scientists from around the country at various universities reached out to you and asked to collaborate with you and have access to your data. What kinds of questions do they want to ask? What do they think that you have left uncovered with this data?
I think some of them are looking at actually addressing the problem. So some of them were talking about creating things like working panels that would allow people to look at their communities and identify specific health threats, whether it be smog from air pollution, lead poisoning, things like that. They wanted to put a comprehensive, this is what you're in danger of in your community, and this is what you should address. I think others were looking at, it's kind of more of a social examination. What impact does lead poisoning have on school performance? What impact does lead have on crime, poverty, things like that?
Okay. Again, super work. Thanks for sharing it.
Thank you.
All right. So next I'm going to turn to the scientist on this panel, Bernie. And again, I point you to the deep and rich biographical data and links that we have on the SEJ conference website for more background on Bernie, who played a pivotal role in regulation, has a career that spans both government and academia. And he works now for our host here, the University of Pittsburgh. Bernie, tell us a little bit more about what you think journalists need to do with data such as Mike and his reporting partners have collected here.
Well, first, let me congratulate Mike. That's exactly what's needed. As he points out, the outrage from Flint, the justified outrage has led to people knowing about this, being concerned about this. To me, and I've been involved, I've saw kids lead poisoned at Bellevue Hospital more than 50 years ago. To me, the issue remains a quintessential environmental justice issue. You'll hear more about that, I know, from some of the other speakers. But it is an issue of I very often call WIMBY. You've heard of NIMBY, not in my backyard. WIMBY is why in my backyard. Mm-hmm. NIMBY, we find out they want to put a methadone clinic in there. We go fight it. WIMBY is you wake up one morning and it's been done to you. And this is what happened there. And it's got a broader context than lead. But lead has always been an environmental justice issue. Just consider if lead was if something that was in middle-class housing that affected kids' IQs, or for Mike at top, I very often said, if that affected kids' IQs, Congress would have voted the money. We would have gotten rid of all of this a long time ago. We would have dealt with lead a long time ago if it weren't for the environmental justice aspects of it that lead us to not take this as seriously as we should. One of the problems, though, that I saw with Mike's approach, and I've seen less with his than with a lot of others, I can best describe as during the summer when this was hitting the news, I taught a class for undergraduates who might be interested in public health, and I gave the environmental thing. And I asked them, if you got a real job a couple of years from now, and you were given your first chance to hire someone, and the HR sent you three CVs of possible hires, and one of those kids had graduated from Flint High School, would you take that into account? Your job requires you to requires this new person to learn on the job? And they said yes. And why would anyone be surprised? What you hear over and over again is that these kids have been permanently damaged. Toxic death is the headlines. This is not a good thing to happen. From a public health point of view, we've got to get lead down as low as we can. But from an individual medical point of view, it is very often difficult to see what difference it makes on the individual. The average person age 50 and above in this room had about three times the blood lead levels than the kids in Flint have. President Obama went to Flint and gave a speech at the local high school. It was well covered in the press. My graduate student looked at the coverage. President Obama pointed out that there was stigma being given to these kids, and we've got to avoid this stigma. And he made a big point about it, and I know the federal official who wrote that for him. That wasn't covered at all by the press. You can't tell a kid that you can't learn, that you're too, you know, you've been horribly affected, your brain's damaged, you're not going to be able to learn. So we've got to worry about that aspect of it, as well as the aspect of making sure we get that lead level low as we possibly can. Just one number to throw at you, the lead level in Flint, the action level that Mike's worked on so hard and so many of others have, is 5. My level when I was a kid was probably between 15 and 20. The previous level, which was called the level of concern, was 10. CDC dropped that down to 5 as a reference level. 2.5% of the kids in the country have that reference level. The intention is, as we do national surveys, require national surveys, which we don't do often enough, we will get down to always be what – we will keep lowering this to whatever the 2.5% level is for kids. So it's not something which, when you exceed 5, means that you're horribly brain damaged and you can't learn, and we've got to make sure we get off of that kind of communication to the public. Finally, it's a situation in which, thank goodness for all that you've done in communicating to make sure that people pay attention to this and people do work to cut down on the lead levels.
Bernie, just a really quick follow-up question. As journalists, what can we do? What kind of stories can we do that will move the country towards eliminating lead poisoning?
Well, I think you're doing a lot of a really good job right now. I think, again, a focus on the lead levels in the inner city. But I would take the environmental justice issue one step further and to say that if you can show that the lead is also affecting people who perhaps may have more power in our society, that this is a way to go. So some of the highest blood lead levels I've seen in recent years, one was in an upper middle class family whose father was had a hobby of making toy soldiers out of lead, which he was doing in the basement. And the boys in the family all had very high blood lead levels, 50, 60, 70. Not the girls, because they weren't playing with toy soldiers. Things like that. Construction worker, blood lead level over 100. Not somebody who's working construction on his regular job, but who was flipping houses and was sanding an old house in Red Bank, New Jersey, which is an old Victorian. Bought a surgical mask. But surgical masks really don't do any good. You breathe out of the side of them if you're doing something which requires energy. And he had a blood lead level of over 100. Misdiagnosed for quite some time. The local physicians told him he was having a problem with his girlfriend, and that must have been the cause for all of his vague symptoms. So got to focus on some of those issues as well and make sure everybody understands that surveillance, as Mike has so well pointed out, surveillance is crucial. In Pittsburgh, we finally have surveillance, and if it wasn't for Flint, we would not have had a new bill passed on requiring surveillance.
Okay, thank you. So now I'm going to turn to Derek Jackson at the end of the table. Derek is a longtime editor at the Boston Globe, still writes a commentary column for the Boston Globe. He has also recently been a fellow at the Harvard's Shorenstein Center, which looks at public affairs issues, and he is now also working for the Union of Concerned Scientists, helping scientists with their communication on environment and other public science issues. So when he was at the Shorenstein Center, as you can see in the bio information, he produced a really exhaustive report on coverage of the Flint water crisis and pointed out that as a profession, we were late to the story. So, Derek, tell us more about your conclusions about why this happened and how, as an individual journalist and also as a community of journalists, we can avoid this kind of oversight in the future.
No, thank you, Amelia. What I'll do is I'll start off with what is the kind of a nut set of paragraphs, not too long. The New York Times did their first major story on Flint 11 months after the water was switched. I argue that that 11-month gap missed tremendous amount of things. So I'm just going to not to pick on the Times, because all of the national media missed the story in major ways. And so the Times had a story very briefly that seemed to, if you weren't really analyzing it, quoted some residents, you know, were being harmed, quoted state and local, the governor, representative of the governor, and the mayor at the time, Dane Walling, about that, oh, everything's fine. And I'm going to say, but the Times parachuting into the crisis missed things that would have made the story more urgent. There was no mention of the months of marches and frigid weather. There was no mention of the many bottled water giveaways in which all the sectors of local society participated, Catholic charities to Muslim ex-prisoners and from CEOs to secretaries. While emergency manager Jerry Ambrose and Mayor Dale Walling were granted six paragraphs to say the water was safe and they were doing everything they could, there was not a single quote or single identification of any of the local politicians who for months challenged the proclamations of safety from the mayor and the state-appointed city manager. The story mentioned General Motors in the history of Flint, but they made no mention of the company fleeing from Flint's water, which they did in October, because the water rusted its engine parts. It made no mention of the Children's Museum telling children not to drink the water. It missed the Facebook communities being formed to protest the water and letters to the mayor and to the editor of the Flint Journal. After a strong opening with Melissa Mays, one of the top protesters of the water, the Times story made no more attempts with the other residents to lay out the broad array of irritations and illnesses besetting the population. Adding it all together, the space given Ambrose and Walling compared to just one sentence given to city council members who voted to go back to the Detroit water, the omission of red flags such as the rusted GM parts, and the absence of any narrative that the people themselves, from almost day one of the switch of water in April of 2014, that they were pushing back and trying to pull together, gave the first national story of the Flint water crisis the appearance of granting far too much deference to those in power. This would seem to violate the Society of Professional Journalists' code of ethics for newspapers to give voice to the voiceless, as well as Finley Peter Dunn's admonition more than a century ago for the press to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. The downplaying of community action by the Times, however unintentional, may have created a self-fulfilling lack of urgency, for neither that newspaper nor any other major newspaper or television station outside of Michigan would return to or visit the story of the Flint water crisis for another half year. So that hope it sums up in lots of ways the kind of thesis of the paper, which is that almost to the self-fulfilled prophecy that many environmental justice people like Robert Bullard, Texas Southern, Peggy Wright down at Dillard College, there are many people who have always lamented the lack of coverage of environmental justice issues. And as Robert Bullard said, we're kind of doing this right now with the heroin opioid crisis. When it was, if I can do a brief aside, that brings it right up to today. When it was supposedly crack in black communities, the response was prison, dysfunctional families, blaming the victim and imprisoning the victim. Now today that the opioid heroin crisis has hit vast swaths of white America, the call is for public health, mental health interventions, and what can we do to help these individuals out and not blaming whole entire communities for their pathological dysfunction. So in lots of ways, Flint, it was amazing. Let me give some credit, Amelia. I'd be very remiss to say this and not give credit to the Flint Journal, the Michigan Public Radio, and Kurt Guyett of the American Civil Liberties Union's division in Michigan. They were pounding, they were writing the stories, they were broadcasting stories, and doing stuff that made it very clear that from day one, residents were complaining that the water was orange, it was brown, it smelled, my kids had rashes, and somehow that did not rise to the level of national attention, and I think the coup de grace was, in fact, water was switched in April of 14. General Motors pulled the plug on the water October 14, saying that it's rusting. It's unbelievable in retrospect that something that was rusting car parts in real time would not get one editor around the nation to say, if it's rusting car parts, what is it doing to human people, human bodies?
Thank you, Derek. Any ideas on what we can do as individuals and as a community to address this kind of problem and make sure it doesn't happen in the future?
You mean as journalists?
As journalists, right.
Sure. The number one thing is that we have to start giving residents, quote, ordinary people, the same kind of power of their words and their experience as we give doctors, lawyers. So the biggest thing that one of the sub big things in the paper is that the national media did not respond until, quote, authoritative people confirmed of lead poisoning. And that, of course, for those of you who know this story, Mona,
Hannah Atisha.
Right. When she came out with her results, when Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech came out with his results, then all of a sudden it was legitimized. You know, I almost want to say, my God. I mean, it was like people were saying this is now, by the time that she confirmed, the confirmations were almost like a year and a half into the crisis. So had the media, reporters beyond Michigan paid attention to the protests that were in the streets, the efforts, as I said, from Catholic Charities to Muslim ex-prisoners. I mean, it was, first of all, it's diverse. It was diverse along lines of race, religion, class. A national attention to that, would have been quite a fascinating story of unity in the face of something. Also, you got to believe it would have brought significant pressure to bear on the governor's office to have done much more than have their appointed managers Early and Ambrose to say everything is cool.
Thank you. So, yeah, I want to point out that we've had an ongoing conversation over the last few years at the SEJ conference on this topic. We had last year in Sacramento another panel more focused on Flint than this one. It's kind of more generally on lead issues. And two of the reporters that Derek cited for having done a lot of reporting on this topic, that Ron Fonger from the Flint Journal and Kurt Guyett from who's now working for the ACLU in a journalism role, we're on that panel, and we're anticipating that all those people will be involved at our next conference in Flint, Michigan, a year from now. But right now, I'd like to turn to Talia Buford, who did graduate from a high school in Flint and is now working for ProPublica. And she, as you can see in the bios that are posted on the SEJ agenda, they link to her prize-winning series on environmental justice and how the EPA responds to that. That were published when she was working recently for the Center for Public Integrity. So, and as part of that series, she did a really interesting column, personal opinion piece, talking about how, even as a reporter who's covering environmental justice, who is from Flint, she was not early on the Flint story. So, Talia, can you talk a little bit about how that happened and how you see an opportunity for other journalists to avoid that in the future?
Sure. So my mom still lives in Flint, but I do not. I have not lived in Flint since I graduated from high school. I promptly moved away and have not moved back. And so when I go home, it's probably the same way a lot of you go home. You go home, you see your family, you see your friends. You're not necessarily maybe keeping as close an eye on the local politics of your town. And maybe that's because I revert back to, like, my teenage self when I think about Flint. I'm just like, oh, okay, it's just Flint being Flint, whatever, it's fine. You're not thinking about it in a reporter context because I'm really going home, you know, for Christmas. You know, I'm not thinking about these things or whatever. My mom is, she's retired. She is not necessarily a, vulnerable person in the, context of like having children, who are school aged or, you know, also my mom also has been drinking bottled water for years. So the fact that she had to buy more bottled water wasn't a big deal to her because it was just like, oh, well, she literally has been, I've been trying to get her off of bottled water because I'm like, oh, it's all wasteful. You should stop. You should really just use, you know, tap water. And she completely ignored me, thankfully. But I think that, you know, so some of the things that are that in retrospect are little bellwethers or kind of, you know, canaries in the mine, like I missed because my mom wasn't dealing with them. And so when I talked to her, she wasn't saying, oh, you know, I had to go buy my water because she was always buying water. When they started to give away water, I was like, well, by that time, you know, it was everywhere and I knew what was going on. And some of the smaller things that were leading up to the water issue, I was not watching any of the city council meetings or anything like that. But I remember she told me that there were some boil water advisories and some, you know, flushing. I saw some pictures on Facebook of people showing hydrants flushing brown water. And I kind of reasoned it away. I'd covered local governments in the past. I know that people have boil water advisories for any number of reasons. I know that there are times when they flush hydrants, then it comes out in weird colors for any number of reasons. And so I said, okay, well, these things in isolation are not necessarily a thing that I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be some sort of water crisis. I'm thinking, okay, that's kind of weird. Okay, just make sure you don't drink the water right now. Like, you'll be fine. But then as things kind of kept going on and there were more boil water advisors, there were more flushings, there were more just things that were happening, it was like, you know, is everything okay? And not to blame my mom, but, you know, she's like, you know, it's fine. Like, whatever. Things are fine. They're telling us it's okay. She was not going to city council meetings and protesting. So, again, I didn't have a direct connection there. And by the time it hit the national media, and that's another thing that is my fault, I was a national reporter. And I still am. I'm not doing that anymore. I was not paying a lot of attention to a lot of the local newspapers. I wasn't reading the Flint Journal. I was not, you know, reading the Detroit Free Press as much as I probably should have, or as much as I used to in the past. I was, you know, focusing on my project as opposed to kind of really keeping up with a lot of the other stories that are happening in communities all around the country. And so when it did make it to, you know, the New York Times, the sources that I was reading, I called my mom and I'm like, well, really? Like, what's going on? I've been talking to you every week for months now. You've not mentioned this. She's like, oh yeah, they've had that. But, you know, we talk about, you know, what she did that day and, you know, what she made for dinner, not, you know, whether or not the water is contaminated. It's just not something that she was thinking about at the time. And even now, I have to ask her about it. Because when I go home to Flint, at least, it's just a part of daily life now that this is what this is. She'll sometimes tell me, I went and went to the water pickup and they filled my car up with water, and it's just like another errand that she runs. So it's interesting talking to her because I know, you know, kind of, you know, you can see the magnitude of the story, and she's just like, well, I'm just, you know, living my daily life, and that's what's happening for her. As far as like why I missed the story, in the story that I wrote, I mentioned that, one, it's very easy to dismiss, one, people in your own hometown or a place that you think that you know. So for me, Flint is or at least the Flint that I know, is a predominantly Black Flint. It is middle to lower class. It is kind of the stepchild of Michigan. It was in financial crisis for years, but nobody cared about the financial crisis in Michigan until Detroit went bankrupt, you know? So it's like, that's kind of how we always felt. It's like, we were struggling for a long time and no one cared, so why would they care now, kind of thing. And so I kind of internalized that probably a little bit. And so it's like, oh, well, Flint's just being Flint. Like, something's wrong. Of course something's wrong in Flint and no one's going to do anything. So, and you kind of, well, I forgot that, wait, I can do something. You know, I am no longer just a kid in high school. I'm a reporter at a national organization, and this is something that I could have said, or I could have done something here. Could I have, you know, broken the story wide open? Probably not. I mean, I'm not on the ground there. And Kurt obviously had was way ahead of a lot of people. But I do regret not pushing further and saying, you know what, one, that just because I'm from this area doesn't mean that I don't, it's that it's inappropriate for me to report on it. That's one. Also, two, that even if these are just people who are complaining or whatever, that, you know, hey, it's worth listening to them. Like, it's not going to cost us that much money. Let's just test some water. Like, what can it hurt, kind of thing. So there's a number of different things that I think led to why I missed the story personally. Most of it was just really not paying attention. And I think that that's what happens in a lot of places.
Yeah, I think it's a story that resonates because many of us can relate to that kind of. We all miss stories, you know, there's so many stories out there. It's hard to catch them all. It was courageous of you to write about it that way, and I think really helpful. So thank you for doing that. So at this point, what do you see as what would you like to see as a next step for the story in Flint? What would and specifically for journalists coming from outside of Flint, how would you like them to behave and talk to people in Flint?
Oh gosh, I feel like your mother's now. Okay, I will say this. So I do not live in Flint. But anytime that I tell someone that I'm from Flint, I get, it's like this weird thing people do. Their face kind of drops a little bit, and then their voice becomes very soothing and like sympathetic toward me. And I just kind of brush it off because I understand that it's coming from a good place. It is also very irritating. And I know that if people are speaking to me in that way, and I don't even live in this place, I don't have to wash my teeth, brush my teeth with bottled water, I don't have to wash my hands with bottled water, that when you go into these communities with people who actually are living this as a reality, that you're doing that in maybe times 10. And it's really condescending. And I think it's just... really, there's a difference between being empathetic and making someone feel less than somehow for where they're from or what they're experiencing. And I think that kind of having that empathy, but not turning a person into a victim, is a fine line. And I think that it's something that we probably need to do better. And I'm sure that I'm guilty of it on a number of different levels in different communities. But I think it's something we need to be aware of and something that we should work to do better at. And I think just listening to the people, allowing people to tell you their stories and not kind of going in and saying, okay, well, you know, well, what is it like, you know, doing this and that? And it's like, yeah, you tell those things, but, you know, don't go in assuming that, I guess that, not that things are horrible because things are horrible, but like allow them to tell you their story and actually listen to them and not just assume that they are something to be pitied, I guess, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So.
I like to, Amelia, yeah. I like to second, tie on that last point about victims, because a huge fallout of the national coverage of Flint precisely because they missed all the agency and activism of the people in that first year. The vast majority of the coverage afterwards was all about they were all victims. And they were all terribly damaged, harmed victims, and not people who, at the very beginning, tried to exercise their power, personal power, democratic power of protest. And so I think as journalists, we have to be extremely conscious of going into these communities, such as you just said, of trying to get to where they are, get to them quick enough so that you catch them in their, quote, agency, their self-power. Because if you don't do that, then the stereotypes of this country about poor people, people of color, are so powerful that even if it's not meant, if the reporters and editors don't mean it, it comes out as just this, like, woe's me, and then it becomes like, they're waiting for handouts, and every possible negative stereotype of a victimized person gets rolled out, and therefore, in the end of the day, that contributes to something that I think should, I'm going to mention now quickly, we can expand upon if anybody has questions. It led to the national coverage being dominated by what I would call the white hero narrative. So it became down to the heroes of the Flint water crisis. Virtually no African American in the entire national coverage was labeled a hero, literally, quote, a hero of the water crisis, whereas Mark Edwards was repeatedly called a hero. What's the first name? No, one of the white victims of Flint.
Virginia.
Walters. She now lives in Virginia. She was repeatedly called a hero. Mona Hanna-Tisha, who's Iraqi-American, and in my paper, she actually admits to this, that she was chagrined about the white hero narrative. She was the only person of color who was labeled a hero, yet the city's 57% black. And it took outlets like Al Jazeera, English, British newspapers, all kinds of external press actually did recognize that there were black heroes of the crisis. But not the New York Times, not the Washington Post, not National Public Radio, not any national American outlet. And I think that shows you how powerful the stereotypes are in this country.
Excellent point. Okay, I have one last question for Talia, then we'll open it up for audience Q&A for about 20 minutes. So Talia, we want more people who graduate from Flint High Schools to become environmental journalists. Can you briefly tell us about your path? What were the key points along the way, and and what would you suggest that we as journalists who are already working in this field can do to help encourage more people from Flint to and places like Flint to join our profession?
So I guess I started in journalism at the Flint Journal as a high school student. They used to have a teen section, actually, that allowed you. We had a weekly section where we would, you know, put out, you know, a section of the newspaper. And so I got to write stories about, like, suspensions and, you know, CD reviews and, you know, stuff like that. But that was at the time when the Flint Journal was a much more robust newspaper. It was actually publishing in print every day. A lot of the investment, obviously, is no longer there. But that allowed me to have an incubator to really try it out and see if I liked it. And then I think I was not a science or environmental reporter for most of my career. So I guess I would have to probably give a lot of credit to Politico. I was working at Politico I had graduated from grad school, and I was a legal reporter before that. And had transitioned into covering policy, and they happened to have a job covering energy policy. And I said, oh, okay, I'll give it a shot. But I need you to give me time to, you know, ramp up and to understand, you know, natural gas and understand fracking and to understand, you know, kind of what these different policies are. And to their credit, they said, okay. And I think that's probably the one of the turning points, because I was just given the chance to learn something. I still had to produce things, and I still worked at Politico. So, I mean, there was that. But they had the chance to kind of say, to kind of, like, poke around and to kind of, they weren't expecting me to write, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, deep dive into fracking, you know, my first week in. They said, okay, you know, just start covering these hearings, start doing this, start doing that, and really doing a lot of that beat and foundational work, and giving people the chance to be a little anonymous for a second and not expect everyone to be a star kind of right off the bat. And so that gave me the chance to really understand a lot about natural gas and kind of get into environmental reporting. And so that's kind of how I got here today. And so I think that if that anything, to kind of the prescriptive side, is if you have an organization that has, you know, a high school component or can work with your, you know, local kids in your high schools or in your colleges, in your towns or nearby, giving them exposure to, one, the craft that we do, but also to the different aspects of environment and science reporting, I think is super helpful, and I think it can go a long way in kind of helping to build the ranks.
Okay, super, thank you. So now I want to quickly review our Q&A policies that are the same throughout all the SEJ conference sessions, and that is that we are going to take questions from journalists first, people wearing the blue badges, journalists and SEJ members, and we want each person to who's asking a question to state their name and their affiliation, and then actually ask a question. Don't just offer an opinion. Because we're recording, I'm going to repeat the question so that people who are listening to the recording will also understand where the response is coming from. So, who has the first question? Okay. How about want to line up? We'll just do a lineup right here.
Or actually, you want us to get up?
It would be helpful because I want to be fair, you know, and not just pick only people that I see in the front. You know, so a lineup would be great. But you, why don't you start us? Yes. Go ahead.
Special treatment. Okay, I'm Sharon Lerner. I'm from The Intercept. Thank you all for your presentation. I have two questions. Michael, I'm interested in your FOIA process. I spend a lot of time FOIAing, and I spend a longer time waiting. And I'm curious both about, were you specifically asking for testing rates and results? And how did you get 50 states to respond? Did you really FOIA 50 different states and you really got them to respond and you had legal help, right?
Okay, so the question is from Sharon Lerner from The Intercept. And it's a question for Michael about his FOIA process. And I'm going to pass.
Okay, so we did not get data from all 50 states. Some states don't collect data on blood lead level testing. there's one state really that doesn't at all, and that's North Dakota. Other states don't collect address information on, let's say, kids that tested low. So they've got kids that tested high maybe, but not kids that tested low. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because you can't figure out where kids aren't being tested if you don't know. But that's just the way it is. So ultimately, we're going to have data on 30-some states.
Going to have, or you do have?
We do. Yeah. We might have another piece coming out soon, so keep your eyes open. we got that data either directly from the states or from the CDC. Some states report data to the CDC. Ohio and Pennsylvania, for example. By the way, Pennsylvania is one of the worst states in the country when it comes to open records law. I'm a proud Pennsylvania native. It's the worst. It's a mixture of just absolute recalcitrance and genuine incompetence. I talked to the Department of Health, the State Department of Health in Pennsylvania so many times, and I just really felt like sometimes it was like talking to a brick wall. And so eventually what we did was we got this data from the CDC because it turns out Pennsylvania and Ohio had been reporting this. Now, Ohio, they were being tricky. They thought they were being sly. We knew they had the data and they wouldn't provide it to us.
Did you get a lawyer?
No. I don't know what your experiences are, but at Reuters, we don't have a vast legal team. We have probably a much bigger team than many news outlets do, sure. But they don't want to get involved in these things. It's very difficult to get our legal team involved because it takes you have to usually bring in somebody that's an expert on the laws in that state, and in particular to whatever agency or whatever data set or records that you're dealing with. So it's really, I think, incumbent upon the reporter to make everything to get their data for themselves. And if you're waiting for the legal team to do it for you, that's not going to happen.
Okay, so we're not going to have more follow-up question on that because there were lots of hands up. So I just want to point out that these reporters from Reuters had about a year that they were working on this story off and on, and they got the prize for the Oaks Award, but their editor also deserves a big round of applause.
Yeah.
All right. Daryl Fears.
Yeah.
Okay, the question is from Daryl Fields of the Washington Post, asking about the Detroit media outlets and how the question is for Derek about the coverage by the Detroit media outlets of the Flint water crisis.
Yeah. The Detroit papers started covering it. So water's turned off in April of 14. Detroit, Detroit papers started covering it in December. There was a series of public meetings that became pretty fiery, and that was the point that the Detroit papers started coming in and talking about it. And one columnist talked to me. We talked off the record when she came to visit Harvard, and her explanation was that and she wasn't apologizing for it. She also said to me that the Detroit papers, to a significant degree, missed the story as well. Although by coming in maybe at the sooner than the Times, they did capture a bit of that energy and agency of people, but not to the extent that the Flint Journal and other people and Michigan Public Radio and Kirk Guyette did. In the case of the one aspect, she said the bureaus beyond Detroit have been shrunk dramatically over the years. So there were far less reporters. So this is not my analysis. This is what was shared with me. So less feet on the ground in the suburban regions or cities near, you would think, of consequence to Detroit, because Flint had been using Detroit's water for years. So that alone, you might thought might have had some interest in the Detroit, from editors. They were not as bad as the national press. They ended up being halfway in between. And the main reason that was given to me was they just had less people with their ears on the ground paying attention to Flint 70 miles away.
Okay, next question. What's your name?
I'm Hope Curran with Wisconsin Public Radio. I have a similar
question. On Wisconsin.
Yeah. You're talking about like the impact that national media can have, but how do we make sure that as like a state organization or a regional organization, we're having that same impact on drawing attention, giving issues, local issues, the importance that they deserve.
Okay, the question is from Hope Curran of Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's also a follow-up question for Derek about regional news organizations and how they can have maximum impact.
Well, Michigan Public Radio did it. They went to meetings. They listened. They got, in fact, they ended up doing a lot, breaking stuff kind of alongside with Kurt Guyette. I think at one point there was some kind of shared leaking back and forth of memos, particularly the memo by Miguel del Toro that he found led and was recommending some action within the EPA, the local regional EPA. What accounts for that? A particular editor or a particular energetic reporter that convinces an editor? So somewhere in Michigan Public Radio's hallways were people who have an ear to issues affecting poor people, people of color, and they don't have to be all black or Latino, although it's kind of funny. I'm laughing because we have a quorum of black environmental writers in this room right now with Daryl, me, and Talia. And you're not going to get about three more in the country. So, there was obviously a level of sensitivity in Michigan Public Radio, as well as Ron Fonger, who just kind of went to meeting after meeting, reported, and also to the Flint Journal's credit, they were publishing letters to the editor complaining about the water. So it's somewhere along the line, and I think regional sources can be really great because obviously, and particularly with public radio, one story in one city becomes the whole state story. So I would point to them as a great example of doing the job right.
All right, next question, Sarah. Okay, the question is from Sarah Shipley-Hiles of University of Missouri about journalists doing their own water testing and whether that's a good approach. Is the question directed at a particular person?
No, not really.
Okay. How else can we move forward on the issue?
Well, Michael's a data guy, right?
I don't know if you saw the Philadelphia Daily News story last year where, or I'm sorry, earlier this year, in which they had soil sampling done across Philadelphia. It was a really cool story, a powerful piece in which they examined gentrifying neighborhoods in Philadelphia where kids had elevated lead levels, and they were looking at these projects, the redevelopment projects that were kicking up lead dust on the sites of former smelters. So I personally think there is a lot to be gained from this kind of sampling. I think it's also risky as well, because especially with water, because you might just strike out, you might not get much. But I think it's a great idea, and I think it would be really interesting to see what you could put together, what type of kits, and how you could make it affordable as well. I think that there are ways to do it. And I think there are ways to do it beyond lead as well, other toxins.
Yeah, I do it carefully. I mean, I understand the limitations of each of the testing approaches, but it's well worth doing, because you really can talk about it in ways that you wouldn't be able to otherwise. If I had to choose, though, I would ask the journalist to look at windowsills in homes that have kids. That's where the old paint is, and the old paint's flaking, and there are ways of testing that with pretty good kits that work.
Okay, thanks. Another question.
My name's Emily Hopkins. I'm from the Indianapolis Star. I am trying to understand better, and no one's been really able to give me a great answer, so I'm hoping you folks will know, where the money that funds testing of children under Medicaid actually goes. Whether that's a different state by state, but basically, like, it seems that Indiana is not alone in the fact that it doesn't test all the kids that's supposed to under Medicaid, and I'm just wondering why they wouldn't do it if they have federal money to do it.
Okay, it's an interesting question from Emily Hopkins of the Indianapolis Star about the money that the federal government is providing for testing children who are covered under Medicaid for lead poisoning, and why this is not happening if the federal government is willing to pick up the tab. Any thoughts?
Well, two, it's not clear the federal government is picking up the tab. I mean, the way Medicaid works, it's the state has to pick up a substantial part of it, and the state very often does not want to do preventive things because it doesn't want to pay for them. So the feds have to lean on them to be able to do this. A second issue is that, as we're finding all over the country, a lot of people just don't want people coming to their door and testing things. So some of the reason that the tests aren't being done is that people don't want the test to be done. Now, sometimes it's a matter of not the people within the apartment or building. It's the person who has to rent things out and doesn't want there to be a lead violation. So some of the recommendations are that we need to do a better job of paying attention and keeping track of violations. New York City has an excellent way of doing it. You can go on any property, look it up on the New York City web, and you'll find whether there's ever been a lead violation and whether it's been corrected. Very, many places don't do that. You could be recommending those things.
I like that.
Oh, sorry.
I think that this can also be difficult for parents as well. Often the parents might be told that they have to get their child tested for lead in their physician's office. And then they say, okay, now all you have to do is take your kid to this lab and get the blood drawn, and we'll take care of it. But especially for working parents who just went through quite a mess just to get their kids out of school and get time off work for them to take their kids to see their pediatrician, now they're being told within the next 2 weeks you got to do this again. That can be difficult, and there's some workarounds for that, but a lot of states aren't doing that. A lot of physicians aren't making it easier. A lot of states and physicians and communities aren't making it easier to have kids tested.
Okay, next question, you.
So I'd like to point this question to Derek. My name is Leighton Register. I'm a writer from Lexington, Kentucky. And it seems like to me that the Flint story parallels what the Boston Globe did for the story about the Catholic Church and how important it is for papers to be able to do in-depth reporting. And it just seems like a sad irony, and if you can maybe agree or not agree, that with these stories that people aren't wanting to read more newspapers.
Let me see.
I just want to clarify, is there a question?
Yeah, how are we going to get people to read more newspapers when you've got these incredible stories that are coming out and papers still aren't selling
okay.
Okay,
and this is going to be our last question. It's from Leighton Register, a writer in Lexington, Kentucky, who mentions the Boston Globe's stories about the pedophile priests that were highlighted in the movie Spotlight. And he points out that that was a big investigative, time-consuming story. Many other stories, you know, that would be very significant require a lot of time. And some news outlets are doing this kind of work, but yet we aren't getting enough people to read news outlets. Is that correct? Okay, the question is for Derek. What can we do about that?
Well, having taken a buyout 2 years ago, I'm definitely sure I'm not the right person. It's above my pay grade where newspapers go from here. It is interesting with regard to Spotlight, that if you, of course, those who saw the movie, those who worked at the Globe know the deep story, that this story was kind of sat on by the Globe for many years. And so to some degree, there is a kind of there's a little apples and oranges, but there's kind of a parallel with the Flint water crisis and the national media missing that story, kind of like in reverse. The local press was there covering Flint first. National press came in, but by coming in late, all the things I mentioned happened. In the case of the Globe, was sat on for a while. Finally, you know, with Marty Baron becoming the editor, the published editor, he set the team loose to do the amazing work that they did. But Spotlight came out. You know, the exposure of Bernard Law and the all that stuff came out like a decade before the newspaper crash. So I don't think I can – that relates directly to readership of papers. That was at that time, it was read heavily. Obviously, millions of people went to see the movie. So I guess the issue with journalism is that clearly great journalism is still being done, but in far less quantity because of the shrinkage of newspapers and outlets. And I would probably say maybe, it's only conjecture, but perhaps the shrinkage of newspapers also was part of the lack of covering Flint, because maybe there was one less environmental reporter at the Washington Post or one less environmental writer at the New York Times and many less editors who... that's on their antenna compared to other things they think should be covered. And also, again, we can never forget, you know, what's the audience for newspapers? My kind of off-the-cuff thoughts include that as newspapers struggle for circulation, are they struggling for circulation among people who disenfranchise people? Because if you, depending on who you are trying to get boost your circulation among, whether that's print or digital, are there assumptions about your audience that then lead to assumptions about what you cover or don't cover? And so I'll just put it out there that the typical model of marketing is we want the middle class or upper class audiences, which tend to be whiter, wealthier, etc., and not African-American, Latino, and poor people, etc. And then to what degree does that lead to unconscious assumptions about coverage?
Okay, very interesting point to end on. And I want to remind everybody here that the SEJ conference is going to be in Flint, Michigan next year around the same time. We are beginning the planning for that conference, and we are inviting everybody here and anybody who's part of SCJ or part of the journalism community to also offer ideas about how we should frame that conference and what are some of the topics we should cover, some of the chores we should do. For sure, we will be following up on this conversation with new angles on it next year. And I want to thank all of our panelists and remind you that lunch is starting, actually, 1 minute ago at 12:15, and we are all supposed to hustle over there because the food is going to be served and on the table. So thanks again to all of our panelists. I really appreciate it.